This week on Potlatch, the president of the Fairbanks Native Association, Paul Goodwin. Paul Goodwin, the new president of the Fairbanks Native Association, tells some of his background.
Well, I was involved here at the University of Alaska during my PhD program in cross-cultural education for the Native students here at UAF, and I had become more and more involved in Native activities, in particular cross-cultural activities, because I more or less bridged the gap. I started in Kotzebue and ended up in the university, so I thought that I might be able to help along some of the students who were trying to do the same thing. And it was a natural sort of a thing for me to do, to use my education and background in an organization like the Fairbanks Native Association. So when the job became advertised, I merely applied for it and was selected.
What are the benefits of having an educational background to go into an administrative position?
Well, one of the problems in Native organizations in general is that since they have grown so fast, all of the available talent in Alaska in terms of the Native talent has been rapidly soaked up by these various and sundry corporations that have just recently been started. FNA, as well as any other organization, therefore has a problem in terms of the corporate enterprise in terms of getting people who are educated enough to run a corporation, a large corporation, and understand all of the subtleties. The way it's been going is many directors will come into an organization like that and they will learn them on the job as opposed to knowing them already by virtue of school. So the education is very valuable in a position like my own, because FNA is somewhat unique. It's the president, and I might add, it's the president of FNA is what I am, and that's somewhat of a politically sensitive office, and so an education counts in terms of being able to write well, express yourself reasonably well, so on and so forth.
What do you educate an Alaska Native for? Do you educate him to live with the skills of a non-Native, or do you educate him to live with the skills of a Native?
Well, ostensibly, education is there to establish all the options for anyone. And I should think that would be the same thing for the Native people. I know a lot of Native people, for instance, in my background here at the University of Alaska, who wanted to go on and be scientists like myself. A good example is I had a number of students who wanted to work for Fish and Game and go out into the rural areas and study fish populations, that sort of thing. You know, in other words, they were going into the sciences and into the basic sciences. Many of them wanted to be teachers, go back to the village and teach, that sort of thing. There are many others, on the other hand, who wanted to be good Native artists. So I think the role of, you know, what we should be trying to do is establish all the options. And oftentimes in cross-cultural education, those options aren't there.
What happens if you try to, you're sometimes accused of imposing one culture on another? How do you avoid that?
Well, in my opinion, the one culture has already been imposed on the other, and there's no avoiding it at this stage of the game. So what you want to do is, since you have that situation, since you do have a cultural interface, like it or not, right, wrong, or otherwise, it's there, you have to make the diffusion across that interface as easy as possible for the benefit of both cultures involved. And well, that's what you have to do. The idea, the whole concept of it's wrong to impose one culture on the other. Well, that may be true, but the point is it's done, it's there, and this is the thing that we have to live with now.
I must from Point Barren through a blizzard of snow. Been out prospecting for 2 years or so. Pulled into Fairbanks, the city was a boom. So I took a little stroll to the Red Dog Saloon. As I walked in the door, the music was clear. The prettiest voice I had heard in 2 years. The song she was singing made a man's blood run cold. When it's springtime in Alaska, it's 40 below.
When it's springtime in Alaska, it's 40 below.
It was red-headed Lil who was singing so sweet. I reached down and took the snowpacks off my feet. I reached for the gal who was singing the tune. We did the Eskimo hop all around the ceiling. With a caribou crawl and the grizzly bear, we did our dance on a Kodiak rug. The song she kept singing made a man's blood run cold. When it's springtime in Alaska, it's 40 below. I could be. I didn't know Lil was Big Ed's wife to be. He took out his knife and he gave it a throw. When it's springtime in Alaska, I'll be 6 feet below.
When it's springtime in Alaska, he'll be 6 feet below.
What kinds of activities is the Fairbanks Native Association involved with?
Okay, the Fairbanks Native Association is primarily providing professional services along the lines that the BIA used to provide. Now, under the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act, the operational goals of that act is to phase out the Bureau of Indian Affairs as a bureau, especially in Alaska, phase it out completely and replace the bureau with Native-owned and operated organizations. FNA is just one of those. So, in other words, we provide all of the services that the Bureau of Indian Affairs used to provide in the Fairbanks area.
Would you mention these services now?
Okay, well, they're very far-ranging. We have a number of programs. Our largest at this particular time is our comprehensive alcoholism program, which is composed of three separate facilities currently, with another one coming online within a month, hopefully. Then FNA handles adult basic education for the borough. We handle general assistance and social services. We have an employment office where we go out to the villages and recruit people to work on the pipeline so that the pipeline people can satisfy their quotas. We have a youth center, which is primarily geared toward the urban youth who have nothing better to do, that sort of thing. You know, we're trying to get at them. We're trying to get at the ones who have drug problems, that sort of thing. And we have a Johnson O'Malley program. Now, this is a program that is designed to get into the existing school structure, which would be the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District, and educational orientation toward Indians. Now, this doesn't mean we want them to teach all Indian education. It's just that we operate these programs in conjunction with the school district so that Indian education will become intermingled with the school district. Okay, and then all of these activities amount to currently about $1.8 million a year, and it's growing. We'll be getting into other areas, in other words.
Which I hope we'll come back to in a few moments, but comprehensive alcoholism program and adult basic education are services that are not designed only for Alaska Natives, but your organization is handling them for the borough government.
Right.
Why do you want to perform services not specifically for the BIA, but for a local government? What advantage is that in having the Fairbanks Native Association do this?
Well, in an urban area like Fairbanks, there is a group of people in any urban area, you know, have problems. They don't have jobs. You have drug problems, alcohol problems, whatever the story is, the typical urban problems. One of the things that let's call it a dominant culture corporation, owned by white people, for instance, and there are many in this town, because of their structure and because of their ownership and because people know that, these people can reach a certain clientele, which, interestingly enough, pretty well excludes natives. Now, on the other hand, the Fairbanks Native Association reaches the minorities much better just because it's Fairbanks Native Association. That's a very interesting thing, but it happens to be true. We can, for instance, operate an adult basic education program, and we can be assured of getting a good sample of natives, blacks, whites, you know, whatever. We can get those people to a greater degree than another nonprofit corporation owned by a wife, you know, man and wife team, for instance, then they can do it. And I think this should be a great source of pride for the Native Alaskans. They have, under the auspices of the 638, it's called the Law 638, the Indian Self-Determination Law, have not only provided for their own needs, the needs that BIA used to provide, but we have not only provided for our own needs, we have reached out and provided for other community needs. And FNA currently has this community orientation. In other words, we're a significant portion of the community, and we want to do our job for the community, and we are.
Ira, hey! Ira, hey! Call him drunken Ira Hayes. He won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey drinking Indian nor the Marine that went to war. Gather round me, people, and the story I will tell about a brave young Indian you should remember well. From the tribe of Pima Indians, a proud and peaceful band who farmed the Phoenix Valley in Arizona land. Down their ditches for 1,000 years that sparkling water rushed till the white man stole the water rights and the running water hushed. Now Ira's folks were hungry and their farm grew crops of weeds. But when war came, he volunteered and forgot the white man's creed. Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey-drinking Indian nor the Marine that went to war.
Well, they started up Iwo Jima Hill, 250 men. But only 27 lived. to walk back down again. And when that fight was over, and Old Glory raised, among the men who held it high was the Indian Ira Hayes. Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey-drinking Indian, nor the Marine that went to war. Ira Hayes returned a hero, celebrated through this land. He was wined and speeched and honored, and everybody shook his hand. But he was just a Pima Indian, no water, no crops, no chance. At home nobody cared what Ira'd done, and when do the Indians dance? Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey-drinking Indian, nor the Marine that went to war. Then Ira started drinking hard. Jail often was his home. They let him raise the flag there and lower it, as you'd throw a dog a bone. He died drunk early one morning, alone in this land he'd fought to save. 2 inches of water in a lonely ditch was the grave for Ira Hayes. Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey-drinking Indian, nor the Marine that went to war. Yes, call him drunken Ira Hayes, but his lands, they're still as dry. And his ghost, it's a lion thirsty in the ditch where Ira died.
Bureau of Indian Affairs is often accused of dragging its feet and trying to delay the process of self-determination. What has been your experience with this agency?
Well, anytime you deal with an agency as large as Bureau of Indian Affairs, I'm sure anyone could develop the idea or the opinion that they're dragging their feet. I wouldn't myself say that they were dragging their feet. Let's say I understand some of the problems that they're facing. Anytime you want to make a corporate decision and the particular corporation involved is as large as the Bureau, it's not as easy as just saying, okay, let's do it that way. It's a long, drawn-out process. As far as dragging their feet, yes, I think that to a certain degree it is built into the system of a bureaucracy for it to drag its feet. And I mean, in other words, you want to empire build and that sort of thing. You don't want to de-emphasize your corporation, but this is what the law has mandated the Bureau to do, is to begin de-emphasizing itself. And of course, that's a difficult thing to do on the face of it. I mean, people have jobs at the Bureau, and naturally, if it means they got to give up their job, of course they're going to drag their feet.
There are provisions for the Native organizations to bring on board former employees of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And has you Fairbanks Native Association done any of this?
We haven't recently brought on any BIA people, but on the other hand, the BIA in Fairbanks has been relatively stable for the last year or two. In the future, we have some plans to take over some of the BIA functions that they are currently providing services now. We plan to take them over and if we do, of course, the jobs will be available for those BIA people who are so displaced by us taking over their function. And that would be to our benefit, too. 9 chances out of 10, the person who works for the BIA in one program or another is a Native Alaskan. And, that we like to see. And then not only that, the person knows the job. So everybody wins.
You're an urban organization. You're in an urban organization, president of it. There is another organization in town, the Tananaw Chiefs, which is a regional nonprofit corporation. Both of you are in the business of providing services to Alaska Natives, although the Tananaw Chiefs limit themselves to services, I take it, to Athabascans. But how does your organization function and coordinate with the Tananaw Chiefs?
Well, we try to coordinate, that's the thing. Now, just in general, Tananaw Chiefs is a nonprofit organization that is designed to take over the BIA functions in the 43 villages of the Doyon region. Okay, now, Fairbanks is somewhat excluded from that. I mean, obviously, Fairbanks is not a village. And not only that, it's kind of ill-defined in the law called 638. So that now Tananaw Chiefs has some functions here in Fairbanks, just as Fairbanks Native Association does. But we try to make them overlap, and we try to be cooperative in those areas that are found to be needful that both of us handle. A good example is social services and general assistance. Tananaw Chiefs provides general assistance for those people, you know, their people here in Fairbanks, and then presumably we provide services for those people in Fairbanks who are not of the Doyon region. Now, needless to say, there's a considerable overlap in there. In other words, a lot of times Tananaw Chiefs will provide services for Eskimos, and so will we. And we will provide services for Athabascans, that sort of thing. Now, what we try to do in those cases is just simply get together with them and coordinate the activity so that it becomes less expensive administratively, and so we can reach as many people as possible. And in the future, I think that we can coordinate even more.
What are some of the programs that you look forward to getting into in the future?
Okay, we're currently trying to develop a emergency shelter program for abused women and children in this area. We have a heck of a problem in this area with alcoholism, but as it turns out, that's not the whole problem of abused wives and abused children. They are abused for other reasons also. We're trying to provide an emergency shelter for them. And as a matter of fact, we're working on that proposal today. When I go back to the office, that's what I'll work on. We're also providing, or we're trying to provide for the community, a long-term care facility for the chronic inebriate and the chronic alcoholic, who oftentimes has brain damage and other severe physical damage on account of their alcohol problems. And we're trying to get on board a long-term facility for these people. This will clear up a substantial part of the very visible problem in downtown Fairbanks once we get this thing online. And that will be, you know, it'll have to be a relatively small facility, but for the chronic inebriates, it doesn't need to be very much more than a small facility. And I might add, if we get this thing on board and online, we'll have it. This will be the first in the state of Alaska, and it will make the Fairbanks alcoholism program the most comprehensive in the state, and the most comprehensive in most states.
When you talk about an emergency shelter program, do you mean you're going to get a new building to put people in?
Well, what it'll come down to is we'll rent a large house, and we'll have a staff at that house, not a large staff. It'll be just more like a live-in couple or something like that who are versed in counseling and that sort of thing, so that when we get into a situation like we do all the time down in our general assistance department, where a wife has been beaten up or the children have been neglected or one thing or another, we will have a place to put them immediately We don't have to send them back to the environment from, you know, that they just came from to get beat up again or neglected more. So we'll have, anyway, a kind of built-in parents, which will be the counselors at that facility, and it will be more like a house. In other words, we want to make the thing look like a family environment as opposed to an institution.
That would mean that you wouldn't have very many spaces open for such people.
Well, probably not at first, but, you know, because an operation like this is an incredibly expensive thing. We have to meet the most severe need, but we can't meet the entire need of the community. But we would be, for instance, right now we're shooting for a five or six room situation, which means that over a period, well, I mean, we can fill those things, you know, say with five people, five separate families involved there. But of course, the turnover is going to be sufficient where we can usually always place a family in there that, you know, has the kind of problems that I'm talking about.
That was Paul Goodwin, the president of the Fairbanks Native Association, and this is Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening. Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.